Hello, everybody, and welcome to MindBodyGreen's beauty podcast, Clean Beauty School. I am your host and MindBodyGreen's beauty director, Alexandra Engler. On this podcast, we explore beauty through the lens of well-being. And on today's episode, we are talking about longevity. If you have listened to this podcast before, you know that I am obsessed with the science of longevity, especially as it relates to skin longevity and how you can prolong the health of your skin through the ongoing research that we're learning about longevity as a whole. So today's episode will be very enlightening. I'm really, really excited to do so. I'm having on Dr. Anat. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Alexandra. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
Well, I am, like I said, very much looking forward to this conversation. And I want our audience to get to know you a little bit better and your background and, you know, why we should trust you, because I know that we should trust you, but I want our audience to be on the same page. You know, what was your journey into medicine and specifically internal medicine? And then how you got interested in longevity?
Sure. Well, I think it's a really important question to ask, especially nowadays with all the information floating around, is where's the information coming from and who is sharing it with you. But so as you mentioned, I'm an internist by training. I completed my training up in Boston for about 9 years. I spent there. And after medical training, I actually had developed quite an interest in the intersection of healthcare and technology. So I actually joined a company that is now one of the major well-known healthcare tech companies called Virta Health. And I originally joined actually on the product side because my goal was to really understand how technology can influence healthcare in a positive way. So I spent almost 4 years kind of as a product leader there and continued to practice, you know, general internal medicine on the side in different settings, including urgent care and hospital medicine. But honestly, clinically, I hadn't yet found my passion. And it wasn't until some family experiences we had during the course of 2020 and 2021, where essentially we learned that in both my wife's family as well as my own, that we have two different hereditary cancer syndromes. In my wife's family's case, it was a BRCA or BRCA. And in my family's case, it is a variant of Lynch syndrome. And so this was obviously distressing for us to learn, but I think it also prompted us to ask the questions, you know, what are the things that one can do to have some influence over these genetic syndromes? Now, fortunately, neither me nor my wife tested positive for these genes, but we have multiple family members who are affected. And certainly when we didn't know yet the results of our genetic tests, we were asking ourselves these questions. And so for me, I dove into this field initially out of my own personal interest, because I really wanted to understand what are the things that I could do for myself and for the people I cared about. And unfortunately, as a lot of people discover, the conventional training that we receive doesn't really give us the answers that I think feel empowering or really reflect the state of the science and where things actually are. And so I spent the subsequent almost 3 years kind of really immersing myself in the field and studying the science, understanding how things can be applied clinically, how we can measure things and understand the impact of different things we might try, and really became in touch with this new field of longevity medicine, which still is relatively nascent and not something that's super well structured yet. You know, we don't have a formal residency training program in any of this. So a lot of this was really just talking to people and a little bit of a random walk, honestly, like talking to people, doing courses, reading. A lot of it is just reading on your own, honestly, which I love. I think if we want to make this more scalable, I think we have to make the education process more robust. But in any case, I ultimately became really passionate about trying to combine what everything I had learned from the standpoint of digital product at Virta with this newfound clinical passion of mine. And, you know, I use the term longevity mostly because I think that it's a term that I think people understand, or at least people understand what I'm talking about. But really, when I talk to most people, what they're interested in is not so much like, I want to live to 100 or something like that. I mean, there are some people like that, but I think for most of us, the goal is, hey, I just want to feel better today. You know, maybe I'm not feeling quite like I used to, and I want to try and continue to feel that way for as long as I can. So it's really more about, I think, health span is I think the better term.
I always love to ask people about their well-being philosophy, because I think it it illuminates a broader part of this conversation, and it kind of like sheds light on the conversation to follow. So yeah, I mean, I ask you the question that I ask everybody: what is your well-being philosophy?
Yeah. So the first part of what I'm going to say may sound like what a lot of other people say, but I think there is an important twist. So I believe that nutrition, exercise, and sleep are the foundations to a healthy lifestyle and ultimately to health span and longevity. Like, these things have such a tremendous influence on our overall function and well-being that we have to spend time addressing where they are now and trying to make them continually as good as they can be as we move forward through life. Now, the twist is that I do think things like supplements and prescriptions in some cases and these other therapies do have a role, right? But in the service of helping you get even better at those things. So for me, you know, because the reality is that a lot of people, it's very hard to take someone who is feeling quite unwell, like, you know, and tell them, I need you to exercise 4 times a week and eat a healthy diet and cook most of your meals. And I also need you to sleep 8 hours a day. Like, it is hard just to say that to people and expect them to do it.
100%. If it was easy, everyone would do it. It's not.
Exactly. And so I think that's where, you know, with the right professional care, you can use some of these tools to help give you those nudges and to help you get those resources mentally and physically to accomplish these things that ultimately are going to be the keys to your own healthy life, but they're much easier said than done. And I think this is where certain tools and techniques can be helpful.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that aligns very well with what we often talk about at Mind Body Green. And yeah, I mean, to your point, if this stuff was easy, everyone would do it. So it does take, you know, a little bit of additional help sometimes. And there's nothing wrong with that. Okay. So, you know, you've talked about your work at Modern Age and how there is kind of like that diagnostic process that you start out with. To dive a little bit deeper into that, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you today was, you know, specifically about why people are coming in to see you and, you know, kind of starting that onboarding process, because you're so inundated in this world and you're talking to probably a broad scope of people. And I'm curious, like, what is the state of folks who are coming in? Like, why are people searching for this as a solution? Like, are people tired? Are they exhausted? Like, is it all of the above?
So it's a great question. And I think it relates to something that I mentioned earlier, which is that when most people come to see us, their goals primarily relate to wanting to feel better today. And yes, there is often an orientation towards the future and wanting to be healthier for their future. But really, the focus is really in the here and now. And so those things span a lot of the things you just mentioned, everything from fatigue to poor sleep to feeling like they can't focus as well. People feel like sometimes they don't have the memory they would like. Of course, there's people who have weight-related goals, metabolism-related goals. So it really spans the gamut of the things that we hear about every day in our everyday lives. And yet, are sometimes not very well addressed by the conventional medical system, right? Like, if you go to your primary care doctor, the average primary care doc, and say, you know, I feel like I don't have that much energy. I feel like I get really tired in the afternoons. Like, I would submit to you that a lot of the answers that you'd hear are not going to be very helpful. You might get some generic advice and, oh, you know, maybe you need to take a vacation kind of thing. But like, there's no precision with it. And like, there actually are ways to get really precise and, you know, with the right tools and with the right asking the right questions.
So, I mean, let's stay on the exhaustion part of it then, just because we're already here. You know, say you get somebody who's coming in to chat, it's to talk to you, and they do feel tired. And that is kind of like their big pain point. What are you telling them to do? And like, what sort of processes are you putting into place to address that?
Yeah. So I think this is where the diagnostics come into play, because I think, you know, having objective data at our side as we kind of try and navigate these questions makes things so much more robust and precise. And so just to address the question you mentioned, right, around fatigue or exhaustion. The first thing we do is we want to rule out any kind of major, you know, what we would call a disease, right? Like anything major that requires more immediate medical attention. And so as part of our diagnostic, we do routine checks looking at blood cell counts. We look at liver function, kidney function, things that touch on, you know, major diseases that we wouldn't want to miss. And it's actually very rare that people fortunately have these problems, but of course we want to make sure that we don't miss them. And then of course, you know, people will come up normal on a lot of these tests. And this is kind of where the workup that most physicians does ends. They'll kind of run these basic tests and they'll say, oh, you're fine. You know, I think you're just stressed. Why don't you go take a vacation and maybe relax a little bit more and just kind of leave it at that. But I think for us, what we know based on the biology of aging is that there are many other things that could be influencing you feeling more tired than you would like. And to give you a few examples, one major one is hormone function. So we look at thyroid hormone as well as the sex hormones. Thyroid problems are actually unfortunately much more common in women than men. And the frequency of that, at least clinically for us in practice, seems to be increasing. And, you know, we don't fully understand all the reasons, but, you know, it can be a major problem for some people. And I think it's always worth, you know, looking into it as a possibility. Another is metabolic dysfunction, right? If people have any degree of insulin resistance or pre-diabetes, that can manifest itself as exhaustion and fatigue, particularly if that tends to happen after meal times. A third possibility is inflammation. I think we as a society became unfortunately very educated about chronic inflammation as a result of COVID, and specifically post-COVID syndromes like long COVID, which are basically manifestations of chronic inflammation. And there is low level chronic inflammation that happens as a result of the aging process. And for some people that can smolder a little bit more and begin to affect people, including by causing them to have fatigue. So those are just three examples that we look at. But I think very often when people give us that sort of an issue that they're experiencing, we find a biomarker in the categories that I just mentioned that suggests to us that, hey, here's something that might be worth addressing.
Sure. And then from there, you know, you find what the root cause is. And then what are you layering on top of that? Obviously, it's going to be very specific to what the root cause was. But, you know, are there like broader themes that, you know, you advise people on? Like, I'm thinking like nutrients specifically. Like, how are you helping people like guide what nutrients they should be consuming, or like what lifestyle changes they should be making, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, just to back up and give you another major cause of fatigue or like contributor is vitamin D deficiency. And so we do screen for vitamin D. And vitamin D deficiency is unfortunately extremely common. So that's very often something we're talking to people about. But what we also look at for everyone is where they stand with respect to their lifestyle. We want to understand how well they're eating, how well they're sleeping, and how active they are. And based on what we hear there, we will always suggest to them ways that they can be better, right? Very often, a conversation I'm having with people with respect to activity, number one is having people do more of it. That may not be new, but I think one piece is that a lot of people, including people who are otherwise active, are not doing enough resistance training. Resistance training is super important for a variety of reasons. You know, muscle really is the currency of aging in a lot of respects. And that turns out to be a gap in the wellness regimes for a lot of people. And so we spend a lot of time talking about these big three and trying to figure out like what are some changes that you can make. And then we have health coaching actually that we offer as part of our ongoing care program that'll help people implement all this. But then, of course, we also look at what we know about what's going on biologically, right? With their hormones, with their inflammation levels, with their metabolism, and where appropriate, we might suggest certain supplements and prescriptions or other therapies that may help them be more successful in that regard so that they can then be even better about their lifestyle.
Yeah. No, this is all so fascinating. And I think it sets like a really good foundation for what exactly, not only that like you do with your work, but also what longevity as an industry could look like in the future. Like, what does it look like if somebody is going to a longevity doctor? Like, what would that look like in the future? Like, I think this is a very good indication of what that could be and like what ideally we hope that looks like, right? This is a beauty podcast though. So I do want to dive into a little bit of skin. I know that skin care is and skin health is something that you address. And it's something that, you know, you even mentioned earlier that, you know, you do skin assessments, etc. So what is the aesthetic component to all of this? Because, you know, it's something that I think about quite a bit and something that we write about at Mind Body Green. You know, this concept of skin longevity and like what that means and how it plays a bigger role in overall longevity. But what's your take on it? Like, what's your take on the aesthetic aspect?
I think it's a great question. And I think one of the really exciting things for me is seeing the convergence of how we understand the science of aging and how we understand the science of something like skincare. And I think this is just a general theme in medicine where, you know, the way that the system is organized right now, we kind of think of things in separate parts. Like we have the gastroenterology department and the orthopedics department, the dermatology department. And the way that solutions are presented, it's almost like things are very separated. And a lot of people do think about skincare as being entirely separate from taking care of your inner health. And I think one of the things that we've learned from research, and I think we're now seeing this manifest itself in terms of products that are now being offered, is that really taking care of yourself holistically is actually the best way to improve the health of your skin. And so I think that's the first thing I will say is that I think there are a lot more people, including dermatologists, especially the ones who are really savvy about longevity and aging, they start with all of their patients in understanding how their lifestyle is, understanding their nutrition, understanding sleep, understanding a movement. And there is a litany of research that shows that being really good with respect to these factors has a positive impact on your skin specifically. And so I think that is the first step. The second piece is that, you know, some of these biological processes we've talked about, like inflammation, hormone function, and metabolism, also play a major role in influencing your skin. And just to be a little bit specific about those, with respect to metabolism, right? When we have inefficient glucose processing or glycemic control, that excess glucose deposits into our tissues, including into the connective tissue underneath our skin. And it forms what are known as AGEs or advanced glycation end products. And think of it as a little bit like your skin connective tissue kind of caramelizing itself a little bit.
That's not a very good visual.
not a great visual.
I don't like that one bit.
But it's a great example of how, you know, being good about controlling your metabolism can have a positive influence on your skin. Because obviously, fullness is something that a lot of people want with respect to their skin. And so step one for that is just making sure the connective tissue that supports the skin, the collagen and the extracellular matrix is in the best shape it can be. And so that's where, you know, metabolic health comes into play. I think inflammation, I think a lot of people intuitively understand the connection between inflammation and skin, often because many of the common skin disorders like rosacea and acne to some extent are really inflammatory disorders at their root. And so the connection there is very often more obvious. But I think another one that may not be obvious is a connection between hormones and skin. A lot of the sagging skin that women experience, especially as they enter their late 40s, and men too, I think that's another thing. Hormonal transitions are not unique to women. Men undergo hormonal transitions as well. But, you know, some of the sagging skin that people experience relates to hormone deficiencies like estrogen. And so very often when women correct that, we do see improvement with respect to those things. And so I think that's a second layer. The third layer is, you know, making use of skincare products and techniques that reflect the latest understanding of longevity, right? And I think that there's a couple of compounds and molecules that I'll call out. Number one is hyaluronic acid, which we understand actually as not just something that helps our skin, but actually something that helps the whole body. There's some research that shows that hyaluronic acid, when taking orally, can have a positive impact on health outcomes and avoiding disease. Some of these studies are preclinical, but you know, the research is promising. And you know, that's one product that I talk to a lot of my patients about is hyaluronic acid, because it really promotes retention of moisture, and moisture is so important for the health of the skin. And I mean, that's probably one that I'll spotlight. I think just a couple other examples would be skincare products that make use of compounds that affect, for example, the mitochondria, right? Like there's a company called Timeline that initially made a supplement for improving mitochondrial function kind of in the body and in the muscle, but they've since released a skincare serum that, and by the way, no affiliation with them.
Yeah, no, I really like Timeline though. I was introduced to them like a year ago and I was like, oh, this brand is cool.
Yes, I mean, I think like that kind of, it kind of represents that convergence, right? Is that like, we understand that mitochondrial dysfunction is a hallmark of aging, and that applies to all of our cells, including our skin cells, right? And so, you know, their product is one that I've heard really good things about. There's other products out there that boost NAD, which we know is, again, this is targeted at the mitochondria, and there are some skin formulations, skin creams that boost NAD and have a positive impact on the skin as a result of that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think everything you said is just so fascinating. And then I think another element of how aesthetics and longevity intersect is that, you know, right now, I think the longevity, like, industry and those who are interested in it is, in a lot of ways, you know, it is populated by, like, a little bit of, like, biohacking culture, which isn't a bad thing. I think people have made that, like, association with it for, you know, when the longevity conversation started. And I think that's changing. I think longevity has entered the zeitgeist. It's mainstream. Everybody's curious about it. And I think what's really interesting about the aesthetic and the longevity part of it is I think you're also getting a lot of people who are interested in longevity from an aesthetic angle. And they're interested in longevity because they're interested in how that they can look better for longer. So it's not just about like lifespan or health span. It's now about skin span. You know, it's about how they can improve the look of their skin for the long term. And I think that element is really interesting because I think it introduces the principles of longevity, which are inherently good, to a broader audience that maybe wouldn't have been otherwise interested in it, right?
Absolutely.
In that same vein is that I know some of like the IV infusions that you suggest for skin and hair, there are a lot of nutrients that are just good for the body in general. So it's like, even if somebody's going in to go get an infusion for skincare needs, they're ultimately just helping their full body health at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
My question to that is like, what are some of those, you know, quote unquote, beauty ingredients or beauty nutrients that have those skin benefits, but are ultimately going to benefit the whole body?
Yeah, it's a great question. One that I'll spotlight is glutathione, mostly because I think it highlights a cellular process that underpins a lot of dysfunction in our body, including the skin. So glutathione is basically an antioxidant that our cells make to clean up oxidative damage, right? So really, oxidative damage is really underpins, I think, and this is at least the way I understand aging, so much of it just relates to oxidative stress or oxidative damage. And just to kind of make an analogy, so we have mitochondria in our cells. Think of the mitochondria as the engines that power our cells. So they're generating energy that then enables the cells to do what they need to do. They need to divide, they need to clean up after themselves, they need to secrete hormones, extracellular, you know, vesicles, like all sorts of different things that they have to do. This process, like an engine, sometimes releases exhaust. right? And especially when that engine isn't working well, i.e. in metabolic disorders, there's even more exhaust. And so that exhaust basically are what we call free radicals or reactive oxygen species. These things then go around the cell and cause damage. When that damage happens, it can sometimes send a signal to the immune system that says, hey, something's going on, we need to clean it up. Because very often when the immune system sees damage, it means that there's an infection. And I'm simplifying things a little bit, but I think that this, I think in general holds to be true. And then you recruit an immune response and you have a low level of inflammation that kind of creates this vicious cycle. And then really that's how you develop aging. Like all these hallmarks of aging that we talk about, I think really at the root of all of it is this gradual buildup of exhaust that then has lots of far-ranging consequences. Now, like we can't really do anything about that on some level. Even perfectly functioning mitochondria are going to generate this exhaust, right? So it's just a consequence.
We can't live forever, unfortunately.
It's actually an interesting thought experiment, right? Like if we wanted to not age, to me, some of it, like there are people who are taking approaches right now, which is like, how do we reverse aging? We're certainly not there yet from the standpoint of clinical application, but there is some very exciting and promising research in the lab. But that's still in that framework, we're still basically aging. We're just reversing it using, you know, these techniques. But as a thought experiment, it would be one question I ask myself is like, well, how could we just not age at all? And I think to me, the root of it would be having a perfectly clean burning engine, which is basically not possible right now based on our biology and maybe even physics on some level. So anyway, just kind of an interesting tangent. So anyway, I think we can understand why it's important to have healthy mitochondrial function and to in turn be able to clean up this exhaust. And so glutathione is a nutrient that helps to clean this up. And ordinarily, our bodies should be able to produce their own glutathione on their own, but sometimes there is just so much damage that our own native systems are overwhelmed. And I think that's where glutathione comes into play. And so one of the systems that experiences some of the most damage is actually our skin. It's being bombarded by UV light all the time. It's being mechanically stressed. There's a lot of things happening to our skin every day. Now, fortunately, it turns over very quickly, but even then, sometimes there can be so much damage that we can't compensate. And so that's why I think glutathione is something that can really benefit the body and the skin. I think it's just important to note for your readers or for your listeners that, you know, something like glutathione injections is something that we do primarily based on our understanding of the science, as well as significant amounts of clinical experience. Right? There are not official randomized control trials always for these things. And I think that's a very common criticism that people who are coming from more conventional backgrounds submit. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to look at the full picture of information, which includes clinical experience, which is often just kind of not counted. And ultimately, we are very honest with patients about here's what we know, here's the data, here's the anecdotal experience. And at the end of the day, it's a personal decision that comes down to risk and benefit. And for a lot of these things, the risk is very low and the potential benefit is high. It's potential, it's not guaranteed, but it's there. And I think for a lot of people, this trade-off makes sense. And I think that's why so many people are seeking us out, is they want that personalized approach to medicine and to their health. And so that's what we're here to do. And I just wanted to talk about that because I know that comes up a lot.
Oh, it certainly does come up a lot. And it comes up a lot in the skincare industry as well. And I think the way that you phrased it is so perfectly succinct, which is that, like, you know, clinical application shouldn't be discounted, but, you know, as long as you're honest and upfront about the limitations of what you know and what you don't know and the, you know, various risk assessment, it is up to the person and their practitioner on the choices they should make. And no, it comes up all the time, even in the skincare realm. And I struggle with even how to approach it. So I think the way you just said it is pretty good. Maybe I'll just like splice that clip out and I'll bring it around with me and play it whenever I need to.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think as practitioners, if we just stay focused on patients and doing what's best for them, I think we'll generally find the right way.
In terms of, you know, lifestyle changes, this is something that we talk a lot about on this podcast. It's like, what are the small lifestyle changes that you can make that have a big impact? Just because, you know, I think people are busy and they're not necessarily looking for shortcuts, but they're looking for things that can maximize the impact, right? Like, what has the biggest return on investment? So from a longevity point of view, what are some of those small daily habits that have pay off big dividends in the long run?
Yeah, I do have a pretty strong point of view on this. And this comes from both the science as well as personal experience, both for myself as well as working with patients. So sleep, exercise, nutrition are all important. But if I had to pick one that has the highest leverage, it is exercise. It has the potential to positively impact your metabolism. It can improve your sleep. So in a way, it can improve the other two. It can improve your mood. It can regulate stress. It really is, to me, the most powerful biological tool that we have, like far greater than any combination of supplements and even nutrition. Like, it is so powerful. And like, there's actually papers that look at the extremely diverse impacts of exercise on our cells. And it's fascinating. It is so fascinating. All the things that happen, like just give you an example, like our muscles are probably the most significant endocrine organ we have. They release so many hormones that we call myokines that have, and exerkines that have impacts across our body. And these are impacts are generally all positive, like reducing inflammation and promoting muscle synthesis and burning fat, just a lot of all the things that we want. Exercise is so profound in that way. And I say that this is the highest return on investment because to some extent, it can even cover up for being imperfect with the other two. So there's actually a study. I actually did an Instagram reel about this a few days ago about how there's a study that looked at, you know, does sacrificing sleep effectively in order to exercise, basically, if you were to trade off sleep and exercise, what would the impact be? And in this particular study, they looked at one subgroup of people who were achieving their goals of moderate to vigorous physical activity. And they basically found that in that group of people who were achieving that, there was really no difference in terms of all-cause mortality and health outcomes between the people who were sleeping enough and the people who were sleeping not as much. Now, again, in a perfect world, I want you to sleep, you know, 6 to 8 hours, but sometimes that's just not possible, including for me. Like, I'll just be honest with you. I can't always get a full 6 to 8 hours of sleep because I have young children. I have a job that's busy and, you know, demanding. It's just hard, right? And I want to be present for my family. I don't want to be working during family time. And I also want to do the things that I love. And there's just only so many hours in the day. So for me, I am not the greatest when it comes to sleep. But I've, again, this is personal experience, but I've done the experiment where it's like, hey, what if I don't exercise as often and I get a full night's sleep versus if I do wake up earlier, like at 5 in my case, and exercise. For me, like the results are so clear. Like I feel so much better when I'm actually moving. And I've heard this from patients too, and we have research that to some extent supports it. And I think biologically, and this is just a theory, but I think that our bodies have a lot of adaptive capacity, right? Like we actually have the capacity to process a wide range of fuel sources, carbohydrates, fats, protein. Like there's a pretty broad range of metabolic tolerance we have. Now, a lot of people take it to an extreme, but it really, like, we have a lot of margin for error that's built into our body. Same thing with sleep, actually, to some extent, right? Like we can actually, to some extent, function without, it's not perfect, but like there is reserve capacity that we have built in, and we can adapt to having shorter amounts of sleep as reflected in this study. I'm not aware of any adaptive mechanisms we have for not moving. Like I think everything in our biology expects us to be moving. And if we're not moving, a lot of things are not happening that should be, and just things start to go wrong.
Fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. So as you can tell, I'm really passionate about this, but like that is the one thing that I try to stress to people.
That is just so not the answer I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to say sleep. You just blew my mind.
Yeah. And look, like this, a lot of this comes from this is my opinion, right? I think that you know, you will, I'm sure you'll talk to other guests who are passionate about sleep, but I have to tell you, like, this is my experience and this is the experience of the patients I work with. And again, my interpretation of the literature and everything indicates that this really is the most profound thing we have, right? In terms of just pleiotropic, broad-based effects on physiology and ultimately longevity too. I mean, people have, you know, Peter Attia, who is, you know, very well-respected physician in this field, talks very often about the extremely strong association between VO2 max or kind of aerobic capacity and lifespan, really. And so there's countless examples of how exercise is positively correlated with better health, that it is the one thing I'm super passionate about. But I think the other things are important too. And I think that they're important to do your best with. But if I had to pick one, it would be to find a way to move every day in a way that you love. Like, I think it has to be something that you love doing. And so I think if everyone invested some time in finding the thing that they love, whether it's, for some people it's running, for some people it's weightlifting, for some people it's, you know, a sport, or maybe it's swimming. There's so many different things. And I think if you find your one thing that you just like look forward to and you get kind of addicted to, you know, you're really set for in a lot of good ways.
Well, and then I also think it's reassuring for people, like you noted, like people who are busy, who are maybe not perfect at getting sleep every day. It is reassuring that there's almost like a cheat code that, okay, I can't be perfect every single night when I sleep, but I can move my body. And I do think that is quite reassuring. I find that to be very reassuring. Fascinating. You totally blew my mind with your answer. Okay, so what does the future of longevity look like? I mean, I feel like, as you noted, this is such a new field and opportunities are endless. And, you know, really, we're just at kind of the start of this conversation, which is a really exciting place to be. So what are you looking forward to?
What I'm looking forward to the most is taking this type of medicine and making it more accessible to more people. And as you can imagine, we have a ways to go. But I think part of the immediate future is having this medicine become more a part of what more people experience. I mean, to me, as somebody who was originally trained in primary care, this is, to me, like what primary care should really be. And so I think ultimately on some level, we have to reinvent what primary care and kind of basic medicine is, which is going to be a complicated process and maybe probably messy too, just because of all the, you know, the about how complex the medical system is and how entrenched things can be. But I think that part of it is making this more accessible. But I think the second piece to it is looking at technology and how that will continue to change how people experience this sort of care. I think the most immediate thing that's on the horizon is a diagnostics revolution. So we have now the ability to do so many more types of diagnostics that enable us to understand at a much deeper level what is actually happening with respect to these mechanisms of aging. And really what it comes down to is understanding what's happening within the cell. And so I think that we're trying to move away from measuring things in this compartmentalized way, like, oh, the bone tests and the gut test and the brain. It's like, let's understand the efficiency of the cell. And like, there's a lot of common pathways and infrastructure that our cells use to do their jobs. And it's really dysfunction in this infrastructure that causes aging. And so we have lots of tools that are coming online at our disposal to understand the function of cell signaling, to understand the function of epigenetics, hormones, a lot of the things that I touched on, inflammation, you know, the immune system, the microbiome. We call it like omics or like multi-omics. There's just lots and lots of different variants of the genome. There's a proteome, there's a metabolome, there's a microbiome, there's lots of other omes, right? And by combining all this information, we can get a really rich picture of people's health. And then I think even further than that, I think are some of these technologies I alluded to earlier that I think at least today are a little bit more sci-fi, but there is promising clinical data, right? This relates to things like reversing aging. And I think one technology that has a lot of attention on it today is this approach known as epigenetic reprogramming or cellular reprogramming, which is, you know, akin to kind of resetting your phone to factory condition. So it's kind of like resetting your cells to their original state. And they're able to regain like all of this, this original youthful state that gets lost. And so there's people, lots of people working on that. And I think that's probably one of the most promising technologies out there. But again, still likely a ways from prime time. But I think there's no shortage of things to look forward to, honestly. And I think that as interest grows in this field among, you know, everyday people, I think that will just continue to push more people to want to work in this space, which ultimately will help us make even more progress. So I think that's, I hope that if your listeners take one thing away is to be excited about this and to find a way to maybe make this part of your life. And I think ultimately it has a potential to change health for everyone.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I mean, what you said about your approach to longevity should really be what our primary care physicians are doing. And I think that is, in a lot of ways, I do think longevity is the future of medicine and it's the future of health. And it's also the future of beauty. It's the future of a lot of different areas. So I know that I'm very excited about it. I know that a lot of our listeners are also excited about it. So I'm certainly excited to dig in more. But anyway, the last thing that I wanted to chat with you about is how you take care of yourself. I leave this up to the guest interpretation because how we take care of ourselves varies. And I know you're very passionate about exercise, so I assume that has something to do with it. But, you know, what's your well-being routine?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, for me, it's about getting daily, I mean, sometimes it's not daily, you know, just because life happens, but I try to get early morning exercise every day. And for me, it's a mixture of resistance training and then also tennis, which is a sport I'm very passionate about. And so I find that if I do those things as part of my morning ritual, which I think for me also includes just this feeling of having some time to myself. And I think there's something to be said for that too, right? I think that we, especially in this day and age, often don't have a lot of time for ourselves. We're so often, we see ourselves as being parents, as being caregivers, as being employees, that so much of our day is consumed by us functioning in this specific role. And very little of it is actually just you being you. And so for me, that's another reason why I love the mornings is because, the time that I get up, no one else is up in my house. So I kind of just have that time fully to myself. And then I, you know, I exercise and then I come back. And so for me, it just sets such a positive, it's such a great way for me to start the day, both mentally and physically. I'll give you another one. And this one's relatively new, but I have been, you know, consistent about it this year. And it's something that I'm committed to. And that is that I really believe in, for myself, trying to cook as many of my meals myself as possible. And this has actually just as much to do with the mental aspect to it as it does the fact that eating food that you've prepared is very often more healthy, right? I find that there is a certain presence that you have to have whenever you're cooking. So one of my goals is to cook 80% of my meals in a given week from scratch. So far, I'm doing it. We'll check in with me later this year. I don't know. But I find that just the process of really focusing on getting stuff prepared, even the process of cutting vegetables, cutting fruits, there's an opportunity to be present. And then also you have so much more control over what you're putting in. And I'm actually not somebody who, unless you have like some kind of major metabolic condition, I don't believe in lots of restrictions. Like I think that if you're using fresh ingredients that are kind of sourced, you know, as close from nature as possible, like you should, I mean, I think food is something to be celebrated. There's so much richness in a lot of different foods. And I view cooking also as a way to kind of celebrate that and like experience and experiment and try things. So that's another one that I'll share, although I'll caveat that it's pretty new for me, but just to kind of give you something else besides the exercise piece.
No, I love it. I too have been trying to get better about, you know, cooking a majority of my meals. I wasn't terrible at it, but I live in New York, so I eat out a lot. I just do. So that's something that I'm committing to this year. So we have that in common. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining me today. This was so, so fascinating. I will have to have you back and we can go down more rabbit holes because I'm endlessly fascinated about this topic. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Alexandra. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. For more beauty content from the team at MindBodyGreen, you can always read along with our content at mindbodygreen.com, follow us on social media, and of course, tune into next week's episode. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate and review us. And if you ever want to reach out with questions or insights or thoughts, you can find me on Instagram at Alex_Blair_. Thanks so much for your time.